Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. It is a real honor today to welcome to the show Professor Mikkel Bunkenborg, Professor Morten Nielsen, and Professor Morten Axel Petersen. Professor Bunkenborg is Associate Professor of China Studies at the University of Copenhagen. Professor Nielsen is Research Professor at the National Museum of Denmark and Director of the Research Center for Social Urban Modeling. He is the co-editor of The Composition of Anthropology. And Professor Petersen is Professor of Social Anthropology and Director of the Copenhagen Center for Social Data Science at the University of Copenhagen. He is the author of Not Quite Shamans. Today, we are discussing their new book, Collaborative Damage, an Experimental Ethnography of Chinese Globalization, which was published in 2022 with Cornell University Press. Professor Bunkenborg, Professor Nielsen, and Professor Petersen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So could you talk about what inspired this book and why you focused on the relations between China and Mozambique and China and Mongolia?
Maybe I can start here because this goes back to, I think, the original conception for this project was something like 2007 or 6 or something like that. This was a moment where everyone was talking about China and Africa in the sort of media. It was also a moment when I was so fortunate to have these two colleagues in the anthropology department. I think at this point they were doing a PhD. And we were just talking a lot. And then I realized in dialogue with the two gentlemen here that wouldn't it be interesting to study this phenomenon of China and the world, but at the same time reaches a little bit out of the China and Africa regime that was already almost emerging back then. And because I knew from my own experience in Mongolia and what I've heard from others, that the Chinese were also, of course, present elsewhere in the world, including at that point also Europe. So wouldn't it be interesting to sort of pool our different expertises, our ethnographic expertises, but our overlapping theoretical and topical interests into a project like this? Don't know whether you want to add something, Morten and Mikkel, or about the conception of the project.
Well, I mean, at that point, we had all been kind of course, in different ways, been having some kind of understanding or approach to kind of China's growing presence in those parts of the world where we were working. I'm mostly working in sub-Saharan Africa, in Mozambique, and where I started working in 2004. And during those years, China was considered, especially by the donor community, as the odd one out, you know, that they didn't have a very strong presence during the first years of me doing research there. But actually, during the latter part of my field work, they really came on strong, you know, and they were something that they were an entity that couldn't be ignored any longer. So from being this kind of almost marginal presence, there was something to be suddenly reckoned with, and I found that really interesting and wanted to pursue that even further, even though it had been at the center of my research previously.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, even the project was conceived before the big financial crisis, but when we got the funding, the 2008 financial crisis was already up and running, and it seemed that the Western economies were nosediving while China, the Chinese economy was doing really well at that point in time, and the Chinese were buying up stuff all around the globe, and we had headlines in The Economist and elsewhere saying that it's China's world, we're just living at it, in it, and stuff like that. So it was an interesting time to start that project, and back then it was a bit of a provocation, really, to talk of it as an empire, as an emerging empire. And I think that has now become less problematical, because even political scientists are now starting to speculate about the possibility that China may become an imperial outfit. But back then I thought it was it was probably quite provocative and new to conceive of China as an emerging empire.
That's true. And I also remember that we actually talked, especially back then, quite a lot about whether it was almost like an empire by accident, the sort of haphazard character. You know, at that point, there was also some discussions in the scholarly community, people revisiting, you know, again, and with good reason, the emergence of the British Empire and how often it starts with traders and trading posts and economic relationships. And suddenly these become so important that they had a protection, as it were. That's at least how it's presented. That they need to be protected from locals. Somehow an apparatus of security begins surrounding it. And then suddenly you have something that looks like, if not a state, then at least a polity or a quasi-polity. And we somehow felt that some of the things were likely to happen and seem to be happening. If I may just mention another, I think equally important, at least for me, motivation for entering this project was that I had been working on a documentary film some years prior in another context in Mongolia. And this idea of working for a couple of months with a team of, it was another anthropologist and it was some documentary film people, how much I enjoyed it, how important I felt it would be to not always do fieldwork on your own, but actually systematically try to do fieldwork together. So I think that was also an important part of it for me.
And then you spent the next 10 years realizing how wrong you were.
Yeah, yes, but you know, it was at least our hope that by, it kind of seemed logical that by pooling the different knowledge and especially linguistic and cultural fieldwork, domains, knowledge, resources of different anthropologists, that you could somehow super, size the ethnographer, you know, so instead of having one ethnographer that maybe knew one language and maybe the other one a little bit more, but then there was always be issues with that. What about having two? And one speaks with the, in this case, the Chinese speaking people who are working on this project in Mongolia, and another one in this kind myself speak with the Mongolian speaking one. It kind of sounded like a good idea, and I'm not saying that it wasn't now. I'm just saying that we probably didn't fully anticipate all the problems that it also sort of led to. And I guess that's to some extent what the book is about, both about the aspiration and I think also the realization of the original objective, actually, the original ambition, I think, has been realized. It's just the manner in which it was realized was quite unexpected.
So what Morten basically is saying is that we, and maybe this sounds megalomaniac, and it totally is not, but we actually try to scale to, you know, with precision, the imperial, phenomenon out there with the three of us, and saying that, you know, they are scaled in exactly the same way. You know, this supersizing of the anthropologist can, in a sense, exactly decipher what the Chinese empire is all about.
And I mean, when you think about it, it is only a sort of like a difference in degree from the usual, anthropological assumption, which is super dubious, that as a single anthropologist, you can sort of uncover a whole culture. Yeah. You know, like, so, I mean, to some extent, the outrageous character of this assumption that we had was not particularly more outrageous than the already existing outrageous argument that a single anthropologist can go and uncover, let's say, Mongolian this and that, or Mongolian shamanism. Yeah,
which is also
somehow a somewhat dubious assumption in the first place. Yeah.
So basically, it's like saying, so what happens if we take the fundamental anthropological misunderstanding and makes it global?
Yeah, and I think
three anthropologists.
Yeah. How many anthropologists does it take to really make a global misunderstanding? You know, three idiots.
And so the project sort of began with this idea of what you call a dual perspective approach, and you're kind of touching on it now. Maybe you can explain what that is and how it developed throughout the research.
Well, the idea was to do fieldwork projects, but to do them together. So we were going to do, Morten Nielsen and I were scheduled to do 3 months in Mozambique doing fieldwork together. Morten working on the Mozambican side and me talking to the Chinese. And then we would correspondingly do 3 months in Mongolia, where I would be working with Peterson. He would talk to the Mongolians and I would talk to the Chinese. And then the idea was that we wanted to study similar things. So roads and natural resource extraction in these two sites. And then by systematically comparing and using the China perspective on these things, we could scale up and claim that we could say something about globalizing China as a whole. But the idea of studying similar things became immediately problematical because we realized that even when we were in the same sites, for instance, Morten Nielsen and I studying a road in Mozambique, I would talk to the Chinese and they would say, well, it's a road, but it's not really a road. It's actually a training exercise because we're moving on to build real roads elsewhere, maybe in Europe. And Morten Nielsen would talk to the Mozambicans and they would say, no, this is not a real road. It's going to go to pieces and we're not getting any wages really for our work. So this is not a real road. So even just studying a thing that seemed very simple, a road, suddenly broke into two pieces by virtue of studying it from two different perspectives. So at least that's part of the explanation why the whole idea of dual perspective approach started falling to pieces pretty quickly.
But if I may just add, almost as a devil's advocate, but of course there is also a sense to which, I mean, all anthropologists who write, you know, I think, or at least this is what the supervisor will expect from them, is that, you know, that when they make statements, it could be either directly saying that, you know, a majority of my informants said this, or, you know, a few of my interlocutors were of the opinion that, What does such a statement actually refer to? Well, presumably it refers to someone who has done a long term fieldwork, who have had a somewhat systematic way of asking people, let's say through semi-structured interviews and participant observation things and observing things, so that a systematic collection of ethnographic data has taken place. And of course, a statement like that one is also based on the idea that, you know, every day when we look at, see the same greeting taking place in one group of people and that greeting with the same name being used in another group of people, that is the same thing. And of course, we can always argue, oh, well, it's actually not the same thing. But at some point, we're all doing the thing that we are studying something, and then we generalize across that. And I don't think that has escaped from our project. It's just that also as a device for telling the very important story about the Chinese Empire, we realized that as a device for most, I think, cogently and perhaps also as a form of capture, telling that story, it would be useful to include our own mutual disagreements in that narrative, in that ethnographic prose, in that particular genre of ethnographic writing.
But I mean, but it's also just, you know, boils down to, you know, we were so, you know, it's so massive a disagreement about things, you know. You know, you have to imagine us going out, you know, some place out, you know, where there was a new infrastructure project being carried out, right? And Mikkel and I come driving, you know, in our rented car and get out, and it's really hot. And we know that we'll probably only have, you know, a short period of time, you know, if it's in a break and the workers have to go back to working. So we rush over there and try to build some kind of rapport. And maybe we have, you know, some extra time there, a few days, and we'll come back, you know, during the you know, several, you know, lunch breaks and stuff. And what happens is that the moment that we then leave this site, Mikkel and I start to, you know, argue intensely, you know. So it's not just, you know, some analytical highbrow, you know, about, you know, whatever anthropology stuff it might be. We just really see the world differently, you know. And it's not just for fun, you know. It's really a massive disagreement, right? So we just thought, you know, okay, either we have to just make this project collapse from the get-go, or we have to integrate these disagreements within the, you know, analytical scaffolding of what we're doing, you know. And that's what we chose to do. And basically, it hasn't stopped ever since. And, you know, it's in the book, and it's in the form of the book, it's in the analysis, it's kind of infused everywhere. But I think that to us, it worked in a sense, in the end, to our advantage, that we had set up a kind of, a methodological approach that proved both to be very efficient and not efficient at all.
Maybe now is the perfect time to talk about the title of the book, which is Collaborative Damage, right? And so you've already touched on this a little bit, but maybe you can go more in depth. What do you mean by collaborative damage?
Well, I guess importantly, and in direct continuation of what was just being said, we are looking at two dimensions or two forms or sites of misunderstanding at the same time. We're looking at the misunderstandings and the conflicts or schismas between the Chinese, often the engineers or managers who, let's say, are working in the middle of the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, trying to extract different minerals. In this, our case, fluorspar was one of them. And the different, in their own right, of course, mutually quite different groups of Mongolians. There are people who are living in the area. There are people who are more like migrant laborers, and they have different socioeconomic backgrounds, different genders. But this situation where it's nonetheless often presented by people to themselves and to us as a conflict or a clash between two sides, the two sides of Mongolians and Chinese, that particular clash, that particular kind of like a potential conflict, we realized was quite similar, if not exactly identical, to the conflict that played out between us, trying to interpret what we saw. And so collaborative damage refers in a double sense to these two phenomena, these two levels or sites of misunderstanding and conflict.
And then also to the intersection between one and the other, because as I mentioned before, you know, the book is basically about the impossibility of maintaining a distinction between our methodological approach and the analytics, you know, and the gradual realization that we had to allow that collapse to work to our advantage, you know. So it's also a kind of damaging to the project's construct as such, you know.
If I can just mention one thing more, that one thing that I personally, but I also think Morten and Mikkel have been very inspired by, also back also my PhD studies in Britain, and this was a time where the work of Marilyn Sothern and the like was very sort of pronounced in the anthropological community in Britain. And, you know, one of the, I think, main takeaway points from the so-called new Melanesian anthropology, which is not new anymore, it's like 40 years old, but like, precisely is this thing that social relations are not about connections, or at least they're not necessarily about connections. So the idea of thinking about the social as if that the more connections there are between people and the more proximity there is between people, the more that somehow is the same as saying that there's more sociality. And to some extent, I think one of the advantages of our material is that it shows, no, a conflictual or a ruptured relationship is just as social as a one that is based on proximity, but its form of intimacy is of another kind than the kind of intimacy we associate with relations of proximity.
But to get back to your question, maybe the word collaborative damage also refers to the empire, so that that the way empire ends up being conceptualized in the book, and I don't know if the two moderns agree with me, is actually as a network of constantly evolving differences and conflicts. So just like the collaborative damage that occurs between the three of us, so it is connected to what goes on between the Chinese and the Mongolians and the Mozambicans. So there is this speciation, this different internal differentiation that becomes the book and the empire.
Of course, we would love to disagree with Mikkel here, but I don't think that we can.
I think it's the first time we've actually agreed about something in the.
Yeah. So can you please take this part out of the interview?
Yeah, I'll cut this part out. Maybe now is the perfect time to talk about these three concepts that you present in the introduction, right? Empire, enclaves, and intimate distances, because I think we've already touched on all three of them a little bit. Do you want to say anything more about empire?
I mean, maybe if I can say a little bit more about the intimate distance part, because to some extent, I guess I already partly covered it before. So the concept we thought was nice because, as I said earlier, we wanted to highlight that distance is a form of relationship, but we also wanted to highlight that the form of relationship, the distances can have different kinds of intensities. And an intense, if you like, relations of distance is maybe what we call an intimate distance. Yeah? And we can find other works in anthropology and elsewhere that somehow try to capture some of these intimate distances. We were inspired by two branches of literature. One is the sort of post-colonial and historical anthropological studies of empires and colonial forms, for example, by Ann Stoller and others. We are very inspired by that kind of line of work. And then, on the other hand, we're also inspired by what I just said, this more sort of a Strathernian or relational anthropological notion of thinking about that, what actually constitutes what we see as the social is an objectification of even more intense, vibrant forms of intimacy, proximity, and distance that are so intense that they only every now and then assemble into something that is visible. Yeah? So I think to some extent, intimate distance, hence the concept, tries to sort of build on these two quite actually different strands of literature and combine them in order to capture the distinctiveness about the kinds of relationships that we have studied or we have observed amongst ourselves, but also, of course, amongst the people that we studied.
The other day at the book launch, someone suggested that you could see intimate distances as the kind of the DNA of the Chinese Empire. But I think that's actually taking it a little too far, isn't it? It's you think of the intimate distances as a more general type of social relation that. We've seen it in our attempt to map out an emerging Chinese empire, but it's not actually tied to that social formation, is it? In your view, Peterson?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I like most things where you say like that there are certain concepts and phenomena in anthropological discourse that none of them are they're very seldom unique to a place, but they might be more prominent to that locality or this cultural form. I think it's a little bit like here. I think that there are. I don't know, wouldn't know how to measure this, but you know, my assumption would be that there's more intimate distance to be found in the emerging Chinese Empire, maybe than in other past imperial forms. But I agree with you that doesn't mean that it's distinct and unique to the place. I think there are other things that are maybe more characteristic, at least on the surface of it. And then, you know, something I know that you have been pondering a lot about Buchenwald, this whole thing about the what we originally called the container empire, or the clunkiness, the sort of hypermateriality of what we've seen. So I certainly find that interesting idea very interesting as well.
But I mean, but that thing about whether or not this is kind of the DNA of the empire, I think that we also have to keep in mind that, you know, at the time that we kind of conceptualized this project and worked with it, that was also the period where some of these kind of, you know, ways of thinking about, you know, relationality in a more political way were also becoming prominent. You know, Hart and Negri, you know, came on strong with their, you know, work on empire and kind of the whole Deleuzian way of trying to go beyond the arborescent way of thinking about relations and see these kind of different kinds of structures. And I think that in a sense, what this book in a sense alludes to without making it into a very rigid conclusion is that, you know, what if some kinds of imperial or even political structures require these particular kinds of, you know, misunderstandings or distances in order to operate efficiently, you know. And what would that then tell us, not just about kind of the relationality of distances, but about the large-scale political structures that emerge through this kind of, you know, scaffolding or building going on, you know. And I think that in that sense, it's not to say that it's that this isn't necessarily the DNA, but it's more kind of a probing and saying, you know, what would that tell us about the kind of the growth of these relational morphologies if we were to consider, you know, a Chinese imperial or the Chinese expansion in different parts of the world in these ways.
But can you just maybe elaborate more? Because I'm curious here as well. I mean, I think like any devil's advocate would ask here, surely many of the Chinese we have spoken to, and also many of the locals, perhaps, although generally less so, were interested in having pretty amiable relations. You know, they were hegemonic, but they wanted to have better relations. They wanted to understand people, you know, it's classical imperial, you know, sort of like attitude, I guess, to be one to understand so that you can rule or and help and, you know, all these kind of tropes. So can you just elaborate more on what you actually mean by the fact that this imperial form requires distance? It's like, surely
in chapters 4 to 6, which to my taste are by far the best chapters in the book, I think that you should read them quite you know, in depth, and then we could do a reading group afterwards. But it's quite elaborate in there. But you know, in the conclusion of the book, we have a case study of a quite peculiar case where a Chinese building consortium wanted to build or was contracted to build the football stadium on the outskirts of Maputo, and while doing so, they insisted on putting or placing a large metal statue in front of the football stadium. And during the entirety of the building process, the Mozambican, you could say, owners of the project, the ministry and other, you know, officials constantly asked them, you know, what's this about? Why are you doing this? What's it, you know, we never asked for any kind of metal statue to be placed here. And according to the Mozambican, our Mozambican interlocutors, they never really got a satisfying answer. They never really understood what was actually going on. And vice versa, Professor Buchenwald can elaborate more sufficiently, but it was actually the same from the other side, that the Chinese artists and the Chinese engineers who were responsible for placing the statue never really understood why the Mozambicans didn't want it. So yes, you can say that they were both interested in some kind of amicable a relation, But the point is not to, in a sense, focus on the subjective intentionalities of those involved, but it's rather to look at the larger phenomenon, you could say the outcome of these cascades of mutual misunderstandings, and then seeing, is there some kind of way that we can give some kind of analytical narrative to what's going on? And I think that that's what we've been doing.
Professor Bunkenborg, would you like to...
Yeah, no, I was just thinking that in a lot of the... of the literature on Chinese abroad, there's a tendency to focus on the Chinatown and the enclave. There's the idea of surgical colonialism as a particularly Chinese form of presence in Africa, where they bring their workers and they build roads, and they have very little to do with the local population. So there's this tendency maybe to portray the Chinese as people who are uninterested in their local surroundings. And I think we in the book we cover several instances where this is not the case. The end product may be intimate distances, but it's not because of an initial intention not to have anything to do with the locals. Just as often it's about the locals distancing themselves from the Chinese, or the Chinese being perceived as overly interested in establishing connections. In the first chapter, there's an example of that. A Chinese entrepreneur who wants to be too close to the locals, and they distance themselves from him. So I think that's part of what is interesting about this book is the many ways the intimate distances play out and are established and sort of organized in enclaves.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
At this point, maybe it's pertinent to ask, you know, the subtitle of the book is An Experimental Ethnography. And really throughout the book, I mean, you've already touched on this quite a bit, throughout the book, you include verbatim shouting matches between you. Why did you decide to include your own disagreements in the ethnography? What drove that for you?
Well, I don't think that there was any alternative, to be honest. I mean, I really don't. I mean, as you could also hear, you know, I hear in our responses to you, and of course we are doing it, you know, to please you and all your dear listeners. But it is, you know, genuinely and honestly true, you know, that these discussions have been ongoing throughout. And so it was actually a very concrete, you know, almost practical issue that we had to deal with. How do we deal with the fact that we are constantly in disagreement with each other? And is there any way in which these disagreements, which were both exciting and fun, but also extremely tiring and exhaustive, you know, were there any ways in which that we could use them to our advantage? And I think that the way that we tried to do it was both to be honest about it in the narrative, you know, as honest as you know, without being too, you know, self, you know, navel gazing, and we hope that we have struck a balance in those terms. But it all, but it's also to, in a sense, really reflect on, you know, what does it mean to allow the methodological you know, approach and the analytical approach and the object of study to merge into one.
Without you know, disagreeing with that, I would say something that ostensibly might sound like it contradicts it, because like I would say yes, but then there are also some pretty, I think, you know, well-established and well-proven forms of writing monographs in our discipline, where the ethnographer uses him or themselves as an instrument for carrying, for conveying central findings and logics about the phenomena study. So often it would be the kind of misunderstandings. For example, I have it in my own book about Mongolia, how I made a misunderstanding, and, you know, I could build a whole conclusion up around that. And, you know, we know that we found a lot of classical sort of anthropological monograph that had this kind of like a feature in them. And to some extent, I guess this is just really a version of that. It's just that rather than the mishap between us and the people we study, is a sort of mishaps that take place within us. But actually, I think it functions in the same way in the sort of narrative. But the other thing I also want to say was that, you know, we know personally and have met on several occasions with both George Marcotte, but also Clifford. So these are figures in the history of anthropology with whom I have great respect, and I really enjoy the work. But I also often felt that looking back on the sort of experiments that were carried out in terms of ethnographic writing in the 1980s, they also seemed a little bit, I think, narrow and maybe somehow also arty, if you can put it like that. There was a sense that one had to be almost like a poet or try to be poetic and adopt forms from, you know, what might call the finer arts, be inspired by the finer arts to experiment with anthropology. And I think somebody, because of our own background, because of our own personalities, because of our genders and our positioning and our age and coming from Denmark, the genre that was much more obvious for us was more like this kind of like almost like stand-up like manner of trying to put ourselves on the spot, but hopefully, as Morten just alluded to, in order not for it to be the aim itself to put us on the stop, but always in the errand of communicating the end, which is to explain what the Chinese emerging empire looks like and how it operates. So for me, these are also, apart from being necessities, they're also very, I think, hopefully, you know, efficient tropes of writing ethnography in a particular and very sort of a conscious way. It's a form of reflexivity, in other words.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder whether it started when all three of us were together in Mozambique, and one of Morten's friends brought a camera, and he filmed us during our discussions. And I think, in a way, the perspective of the book is that camera, and it was established in that field trip, and that's where we came up with the idea of including ourselves in the narrative. And then, as I recall it, it happened quite slowly. It was Nielsen making, we were working on a chapter, and then suddenly there was a passage where Nielsen was making fun of me ironing my blue shorts in Mozambique and refusing to go out in the midday sun, while he was, of course, was working all day and sweating in the outskirts of Maputo. So there was this little passage suddenly where Nielsen was making fun of me, and then that became a model. So we started making fun of ourselves and each other in short passages in the various chapters. And yeah, So I don't know.
But I'm surprised that you see it as making fun of. I would rather say that I'm being loyal to my memories of us two living together in an apartment in Maputo. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I really recall. You know, it's true what Mikkel says that you kind of it started out in, you know, when we had this documentarist friend of mine, and you know, there were these shots of him, and maybe I'm exaggerating here. I don't think so, but this is my recollection, is that kind of we were sitting in our rented car, right? The three of us, Mikkel, Morten, and myself, and you know, having this, you know, very childish amateur, you know, discussion about something that we disagreed about, right? And then our friend snuck out, and then he filmed the car from outside. And I remember distinctly the car kind of jumping up and down, you know, from our, you know, massive disagreements, you know, which were almost physical, you know, to the point of us at some point. And I think it actually ended up with Mikkel coming with some eloquent, well thought out, you know, argument that just put both Morten and myself, you know, I wouldn't say to sleep, but at least to rest.
I'd rather doubt that.
At least for 10 minutes. Yeah. But I do think it's worth reflecting on, you know, what is, again, to reiterate a question from the 80s that is now become, well, it never disappeared, but now it has, we acquired urgency because of the decolonial discussions. I mean, like, what does it actually mean to have ethnographic authority? What kind of rights and what kind of thoughts do you need to have when you establish an authority? Do we have the right in order to make fun of ourselves, and to some extent, hopefully to an extent that is within what is ethically and epistemologically okay with the people we study? Can we do that for the purpose that we hope to achieve here? It's something that we reflect, include some reflections about in the introduction. But I'm personally, I wouldn't say looking forward, because I'm also a little bit scared of it. It would be interesting to see how people, what people will think about this, you know, in reviews or whatever, comments on social media or in seminars or comments to us or others. I'm quite, again, excited to see the sort of like how it will go down in the community.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that one of the things that I've been really interested, I would be interesting to know what people reading the book think about, is that kind of. Of course, during the latter years in anthropology, there's been you know, this focus on also doing kind of lateral analytics, you know, of allowing kind of the ethnography to almost operate as its own theorization, and use the comparison as a kind of optics by which to gauge, you know, other empirical domains. And I think that to a certain extent, what we're trying to do here is to allow that to work all the way through, you know, so that we even use our own internal relations and discussions and conversations to work as a platform from which to do some kind of analytical work. So just to give you one example, we had one occasion in the north of Mozambique, and we describe this in one of the chapters from Mozambique, where there was an occurrence which was could be understood as an act of violence or not, and this is kind of what structures our kind of this collaborative damage going on in this particular chapter. But based on our internal discussions, we, through engaging with that particular instance, we suddenly realize that there are other empirical factors going on elsewhere, you know, 2,000 kilometers away, which had absolutely nothing to do with this instance, which could now be read through this instance going on in the north of Mozambique. And the reason, or you could say what we used to, in a sense, scale these different occurrences were our internal discussions, you know. So that's one way of using this as a kind of, you could say, new ethnographic analytics to work with. And I would be very curious and interested to know what others, think of this way of doing ethnographic, analysis and theorization.
Can I just throw in here, and now it becomes a little bit geeky, but, you mentioned we were allowed to be geeky before, so what you're saying, Morten, to some extent, is that here these internal in our group collaborative damages work almost as a form of wormholes, allow you to revisit other sites and other times. So it's almost like, as if what George Marcus many years ago called multi-sided fieldwork here occurs, but in an instant, in a sort of a space of the virtual. But it's not something you can just decide to do. It needs to be sparked and infrastructured by an event, in this case by an event that you might call collaborative damage. Right?
I absolutely, and I also think that those wormholes, sometimes they are opened up by an exhaustion of our collaboration. Suddenly there was this kind of opening or fissure because of our internal discussions. There was something that we were incapable of doing. We couldn't, in a sense, get the analysis to fit while being in the north of Maputo or in Mozambique. And suddenly that opened up this kind of gateway to other instances elsewhere.
Professor Bunkenborg, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, just that Professor Nielsen is constantly falling through the rabbit hole.
Maybe, and Professor Nielsen already touched on this, you decided to split the book in half, sort of, where chapters 1 to 3 take place in Mongolia, and then chapters 4 to 6 take place in Mozambique. Why did you decide to structure the book in this way?
I mean, I think a lot of it was purely pragmatic. One of the reasons why it took so many years for this book to be published, I mean, it always takes a long time for my book to get published. I don't know why, but I guess that's the way it is. But it's just like, it's actually just really, really difficult to organize co-authoring. First of all, you have to organize doing the fieldwork. But then imagine, we all know how it is to just organize your own writing. But when you're writing with 3 others, it's almost impossible, So simply just to make it happen, the writing process, so one thing happened before another, I think that was actually part of it. So we said, okay, this next 2 months, that always turned out to be 6 months or whatever, Peterson and Bunkenborg, we work on the 2 Mongolia, or this Mongolia chapter. Then in the autumn, which then always turned out to be the next year, the other Morten and Mikkel, they work on the Mozambique part. So that, I think, is actually part of the answer, just pure and simple. But I think another, again, pragmatic answer is that maybe Morten Nielsen less so than Mikkel and I, we actually also would like this book to appeal to an audience outside of anthropology. So we would like some journalist or some area studies person, someone working on global development, to pick up this book, skip over the more geeky internal anthropology debates in the introduction, and read these chapters about Mongolia, maybe if that's what they're doing work, and get something out of it that they can use in their professional practice.
Well, actually, I wanted it to be a cartoon, but they disagreed on that, But I mean, but one thing, I mean, and obviously, so based on what Morten just said, if there are any kind of, budding, authors out there, the conclusion from our project must be, don't ever, ever, ever do any work or, on writing a book with co-authoring. I mean, we started out doing this while I was still doing my PhD dissertation in 2009, which is now, 13 years ago or something like that? I mean, that's just insane. And I mean, even though that we are, I'm really, really proud of this book, but it's also just taking way too much time.
But can I just say, I think actually just to modify, because it's actually, I mean, it's not just because the 3 of us disagreed that it was difficult to write. I also think there's something with the number 3. I mean, it's a bit like the saying is that a group of 3 friends is a little bit difficult to keep stable, in as much as there will always be a sense that one is on the outside. That's not what we had at all. But there's just something that I've co-authored a lot of things, including a monograph with one other person. And I don't think it was just because I agreed more with this person than I do, let's say, with Morten Nielsen, that it was easier to write. I also think there's something simply that is easier to do things as a dyad than being free. So I just want to emphasize that I don't want graduate students or everyone who listens to this to think that they shouldn't co-author things, because it's actually real good to co-author things, both for the job market, but also because you learn a lot from it. So I kind of want to emphasize that.
Yeah, but I also think that the three-person constellation is difficult. And in a sense, it also allowed you to disagree more. The two of you, Nielsen and Petersen, you could be allowed to disagree more. And because you had me sort of traveling back and forth between Mozambique and Mongolia and trying to keep shit together. So that tripartite structure actually made it very difficult to keep it together as a book.
Exactly. This is somehow, I mean, it may always make it sound as if Morten and I are not friends. I mean, we're actually very close friends, and we've also co-authored things where we agree. So I think Mikkel is right that there's something about the dynamic of simply a group of three, especially certainly this group, where things just become intensified, you know, like something that is actually on the face of it a minor, maybe almost non-existing disagreement almost become amplified to the point where, as you heard before, I remember also that shot from that documentary film, and I just remember steam coming out of the sort of the door. Someone opened the window, and you literally saw sort of like steam coming out of this car. And I just don't know why it happened.
Well, I mean, I think that all, you know, the moment that we realized that we needed to explore the potentials of the internal disagreements, I also think that we accepted their presence in a more kind of intense way than what is probably usually the case. I've always, in most of my collaborations, it's pretty straight up, you know. And I think that we also, you know, implicitly or explicitly, you know, really, you know, allow these kind of dissensions and disagreements to play themselves out, you know. And I really still strongly believe that there is an analytical purchase here, you know. I honestly do, but the readers may, you know, decide if we've given the navel-gazing internal dynamics too much weight. But as Morten also said before, kind of the naive ambition has all the time been, you know, driven by kind of this idea that, well, this actually benefits the projects, you know, and then, as I also said earlier, I don't think that we had any alternative.
It's also that, I mean, if you want to take the concept of navel gazing a little bit, like, you know, seriously, like, then I guess it really is refers to solipsism. So it refers to the idea that you could, you know, let's stop talking about the people in Mongolia where I did feel, let's just stop about my own feelings while I did the field work. That is sort of rightly or wrongly the acquisition that some people have made of the more forms of so-called writing culture. I'm not sure that I agree almost always that this about this line of attack, but that often is the narrative out there. But again, I just don't think that when what you're writing about is the conflict between, in this case, three people. It's not actually navel gazing, because it's not solipsist, it's something else. It's a document or a dossier that to an extreme sense reveals the messiness of a research project. And that is a messiness that all research projects undergo, also people working in the natural sciences and elsewhere, as documented by Latour and many others who do laboratory studies. So in that sense, it's actually a form of laboratory studies, but just take in the form of a monograph.
Or if it is navel gazing, at least you're gazing at each other's navels.
Yeah, or through each other's navels.
So we're unfortunately coming up on the end of the hour. There is a New Books Network tradition that I always like to uphold, which is to ask what you're working on now. Maybe we can go down the line in the way that I introduced you. Professor Bunkenborg, maybe you could go first.
Yeah, well, just briefly, I'm working on a new collaborative project called Moral Economies of Food in Contemporary China. And it should be coming to a close, but I've been unable to do fieldwork, and my colleagues have also been unable to do fieldwork in China for the past 2 years. So it's a bit hard to close it down. And well, the point of departure is all the food scandals that China has experienced in recent years. And then the question of what do you do when you can't really trust the food that you eat? What do people do in the countryside, in the cities? And what new connections are being forged between countryside and cities in attempts to do community-supported agriculture and get some sort to reestablish some sort of trust in the stuff you eat. So that's the current project.
And Professor Nielsen?
One thing is I'm running this research center on sustainable urban development and trying to give my free sense of saving the world. But then I'm writing up a book on a project I did in New York on stand-up comedy called Comedic Involution, The Paradox of Being Funny Among Stand-Up Comics in New York City. And the basic idea is basically to say that, you know, if stand-up comics are a kind of anthropology, you know, what's the kind of... Or if they are, you know, anthropologists, what's the kind of anthropology that they are carrying out? And it's basically trying to look at what they do as a kind of paradoxical myth-making that carries a kind of ethnographic insights about some of the, you know, most important dilemmas of, you know, living in a contemporary urban life.
And Professor Peterson?
Yeah, I mean, also like Nissen, I run a fairly large research center, so I spend quite a lot of time on that, but apart from that, I'm also the research leader of a research project, a so-called ERC project, where we look at the attention and its political economy. We do that from a very sort of interdisciplinary perspective, and actually probably what I spend most time at the moment is trying to develop something I call machine or computational anthropology. I'm very interested in the idea of revitalizing the potentials and also, you know, the attempts that have been in the history of anthropology to make anthropology computational and quantitative, not because we should stop doing ethnography, which I love, but because I think we can expand the scope of anthropology by also decoupling the project of anthropology from always being tied to qualitative methods and ethnography.
The book is Collaborative Damage, published in 2022 with Cornell University Press. Professor Bunkenborg, Professor Nielsen, Professor Peterson, thank you so much for your time today.
It was a pleasure.
You're welcome.